Still, that one dog had survived the plague and the grisly victims of the plague. That started him thinking. If a dog, with its limited intelligence, could manage to subsist through it all, wouldn't a person with a reasoning brain have that much more chance for survival? He made himself think about something else. It was dangerous to hope. That was a truism he had long accepted. The next morning, the dog came again. This time, Robert Neville opened the front door and went out. The dog immediately bolted away from the dish and bowls, right ear flattened back, legs scrambling frantically across the street. Neville twitched with the repressed instinct to pursue. As casually as he could manage, he sat down on the edge of the porch. Across the street, the dog ran between the houses again and disappeared. After 15 minutes of sitting, Neville went in again. After a small breakfast, he put out more food. The dog came at 4, and Neville went out again, this time making sure that the dog was finished eating. Once more the dog fled, but this time, seeing that it was not pursued, it stopped across the street and looked back for a moment. "It's all right, boy," Neville called out. But at the sound of his voice, the dog ran away again. Neville sat on the porch stiffly, teeth gritted with impatience. "God damn it, what's the matter with him?" he thought. "The damn mutt!" He forced himself to think of what the dog must have gone through. The endless nights of groveling in the blackness, hidden God knew where, its gaunt chest laboring in the night while all around its shivering form the vampires walked. The foraging for food and water, the struggle for life in a world without masters, housed in a body that man had made dependent on himself. "Poor little fella," he thought. "I'll be good to you when you come and live with me." Maybe, the thought came then, a dog had more chance of survival than a human. Dogs were smaller. They could hide in places the vampires couldn't go. They could probably sense the alien nature of those about them, probably smell it. That didn't make him any happier, for always, in spite of reason, he had clung to the hope that someday he would find someone like himself. A man, a woman, a child, it didn't matter. Sex was fast losing its meaning without the endless prodding of mass hypnosis. Loneliness, he still felt. Sometimes he had indulged in daydreams about finding someone. More often, though, he had tried to adjust to what he sincerely believed was the inevitable, that he was actually the only one left in the world, at least in as much of the world as he could ever hope to know. Thinking about it, he almost forgot that nightfall was approaching. With a start, he looked up and saw Ben Cortman running at him from across the street. "Neville!" He jumped up from the porch and ran into the house, locking and bolting the door behind him with shaking hands. For a certain period, he went out on the porch just as the dog had finished eating. Every time he went out, the dog ran away, but as the days passed, it ran with decreasing speed, and soon it was stopping halfway across the street to look back and bark at him. Neville never followed, but sat down on the porch and watched. It was a game they played. Then, one day, Neville sat on the porch before the dog came, and when it appeared across the street, he remained seated. For about 15 minutes the dog hovered near the curb suspiciously, unwilling to approach the food. Neville edged as far away from the food as he could in order to encourage the dog. Unthinking, he crossed his legs, and the dog shrank away at the unexpected motion. Neville held himself quietly then, and the dog kept moving around restlessly in the street, its eyes moving from Neville to the food and back again. "Come on, boy," Neville said to it. "Eat your food. That's a good dog." Another 10 minutes passed. The dog was now on the lawn, moving in concentric arcs that became shorter and shorter. The dog stopped. Then slowly, very slowly, one paw at a time, it began moving up on the dish and bowls, its eyes never leaving Neville for a second. "That's the boy," Neville said quietly. This time the dog didn't flinch or back away at the sound of his voice. Still, Neville made sure he sat motionless so that no abrupt movement would startle the dog. The dog moved yet closer, stalking the plate, its body tense and waiting for the least motion from Neville. "That's right," Neville told the dog. Suddenly the dog darted in and grabbed the meat. Neville's pleased laughter followed its frantically erratic wobble across the street.
"You little son of a gun," he said appreciatively.
Then he sat and watched the dog as it ate. It crouched down on a yellow lawn across the street, its eyes on Neville while it wolfed down the hamburger.
"Enjoy it," he thought, watching the dog. "From now on, you get dog food. I can't afford to let you have any more fresh meat."
When the dog had finished, it straightened up and came across the street again, a little less hesitantly. Neville still sat there, feeling his heart thud nervously. The dog was beginning to trust him, and somehow it made him tremble. He sat there, his eyes fastened on the dog.
"That's right, boy," he heard himself saying aloud. "Get your water now. That's a good dog."
A sudden smile of delight raised his lips as he saw the dog's good ear stand up.
"He's listening," he thought excitedly. "He hears what I say, the little son of a gun. Come on, boy," he went on talking eagerly. "Get your water and your milk now. That's a good boy. I won't hurt you. Attaboy."
The dog went to the water and drank gingerly, its head lifting with sudden jerks to watch him, then dipping down again.
"I'm not doing anything," Neville told the dog.
He couldn't get over how odd his voice sounded. When a man didn't hear the sound of his own voice for almost a year, it sounded very strange to him. A year was a long time to live in silence.
"When you come live with me," he thought, "I'll talk your ear off."
The dog finished the water.
"Come here, boy,"
Neville said invitingly, patting his leg.
"Come on."
The dog looked at him curiously, its good ear twitching again.
"Those eyes," Neville thought. "What a world of feeling in those eyes. Distrust, fear, hope, loneliness, all etched in those big brown eyes. Poor little guy." "Come on, boy. I won't hurt you," he said gently.
Then he stood up and the dog ran away. Neville stood there looking at the fleeing dog, shaking his head slowly. More days passed. Each day Neville sat on the porch while the dog ate, and before long the dog approached the dish and bowls without hesitation, almost boldly, with the assurance of the dog that knows its human conquest. And all the time Neville would talk to it.
"That's a good boy. Eat up the food. That's good food, isn't it?"
"Sure it is.
I'm your friend. I gave you that food." "Eat it up, boy. That's right.
That's a good dog."
Endlessly cajoling, praising, pouring soft words into the dog's frightened mind as it ate. And every day he sat a little bit closer to it, until the day came when he could have reached out and touched the dog if he'd stretched a little. He didn't, though.
"I'm not taking any chances," he told himself. "I don't want to scare him."
But it was hard to keep his hands still. He could almost feel them twitching empathically with his strong desire to reach out and stroke the dog's head.
He had such a terrible yearning to love something again, and the dog was such a beautifully ugly dog.
He kept talking to the dog until it became quite used to the sound of his voice. It hardly looked up now when he spoke. It came and went without trepidation, eating and barking its curt acknowledgement from across the street.
"Soon now," Neville told himself, "I'll be able to pat his head."
The days passed into pleasant weeks, each hour bringing him closer to a companion. Then one day the dog didn't come. Neville was frantic. He'd got so used to the dog's coming and going that it had become the fulcrum of his daily schedule, everything fitting around the dog's meal times, investigation forgotten, everything pushed aside but his desire to have the dog in his house. He spent a nerve-racked afternoon searching the neighborhood, calling out in a loud voice for the dog. But no amount of searching helped, and he went home to a tasteless dinner. The dog didn't come for dinner that night or for breakfast the next morning. Again Neville searched, but with less hope. "They've got him," he kept hearing the words in his mind. "The dirty bastards have got him." But he couldn't really believe it. He wouldn't let himself believe it. On the afternoon of the third day, he was in the garage when he heard the sound of the metal bowl clinking outside. With a gasp, he ran out into the daylight.
"You're back!" he cried.
The dog jerked away from the plate nervously, water dripping from its jaws. Neville's heart leaped.
The dog's eyes were glazed, and it was panting for breath, its dark tongue hanging out.
"No," he said, his voice breaking. "Oh, no."
The dog still backed across the lawn on trembling stalks of legs. Quickly, Neville sat down on the porch steps and stayed there trembling.
"Oh, no," he thought in anguish. "Oh, God, no."
He sat there watching it tremble fitfully as it lapped up the water.
"No, no, it's not true."
"Not true," he murmured without realizing it. Then instinctively he reached out his hand. The dog drew back a little, teeth bared in a throaty snarl.
"It's all right, boy," Neville said quietly. "I won't hurt you."
He didn't even know what he was saying. He couldn't stop the dog from leaving. He tried to follow it, but it was gone before he could discover where it hid. He'd decided it must be under a house somewhere, but that didn't do him any good. He couldn't sleep that night. He paced restlessly, drinking pots of coffee and cursing the sluggishness of time. He had to get hold of the dog. He had to. And soon, he had to cure it. But how? His throat moved. There had to be a way. Even with the little he knew, there must be a way.
The next morning, he sat right beside the bowl, and he felt his lips shaking as the dog came limping slowly across the street.
It didn't eat anything. Its eyes were more dull and listless than they'd been the day before. Neville wanted to jump at it and try to grab hold of it, take it in the house, nurse it. But he knew that if he jumped and missed, he might undo everything. The dog might never return. All through the meal, his hand kept twitching out to pat the dog's head, but every time it did, the dog cringed away with a snarl. He tried being forceful. "Stop that," he said in a firm, angry tone, but that only frightened the dog more, and it drew away farther from him. Neville had to talk to it for 15 minutes, his voice a hoarse, trembling sound, before the dog would return to the water. This time he managed to follow the slow-moving dog and saw which house it squirmed under. There was a little metal screen he could have put up over the opening, but he didn't. He didn't want to frighten the dog, and besides, there would be no way of getting the dog then, except through the floor, and that would take too long. He had to get the dog fast. When the dog didn't return that afternoon, he took a dish of milk and put it under the house where the dog was. The next morning, the bowl was empty. He was going to put more milk in it when he realized that the dog might never leave his lair then. He put the bowl back in front of his house and prayed that the dog was strong enough to reach it. He was too worried even to criticize his inept prayer. When the dog didn't come that afternoon, he went back and looked in. He paced back and forth outside the opening and almost put milk there anyway. No, the dog would never leave then. He went home and spent a sleepless night. The dog didn't come in the morning. Again, he went to the house. He listened at the opening but couldn't hear any sound of breathing. Either it was too far back for him to hear, or... He went back to the house and sat on the porch. He didn't have breakfast or lunch. He just sat there. That afternoon, late, the dog came limping out between the houses, moving slowly on its bony legs. Neville forced himself to sit there without moving until the dog had reached the food. Then, quickly, he reached down and picked up the dog. Immediately it tried to snap at him, but he caught its jaws in his right hand and held them together. Its lean, almost hairless body squirmed feebly in his grasp, and pitifully terrified whines pulsed in its throat. "It's all right," he kept saying. "It's all right, boy." Quickly he took it into his room and put it down on the little bed of blankets he'd arranged for the dog. As soon as he took his hand off its jaws, the dog snapped at him and he jerked his hand back. The dog lunged over the linoleum with a violent scrabbling of paws, heading for the door. Neville jumped up and blocked its way. The dog's legs slipped on the smooth surface, then it got a little traction and disappeared under the bed. Neville got on his knees and looked under the bed. In the gloom there, he saw the two glowing coals of eyes and heard the fitful panting.
"Come on, boy," he pleaded unhappily. "I won't hurt you. You're sick. You need help."
The dog wouldn't budge. With a groan, Neville got up finally and went out, closing the door behind him. He went and got the bowls and filled them with milk and water. He put them in the bedroom near the dog's bed. He stood by his own bed a moment, listening to the panting dog, his face lined with pain. "Oh," he muttered plaintively, "why don't you trust me?" He was eating dinner when he heard the horrible crying and whining. Heart pounding, he jumped up from the table and raced across the living room. He threw open the bedroom door and flicked on the light. Over in the corner by the bench, the dog was trying to dig a hole in the floor. Terrified whines shook its body as its front paws clawed frenziedly at the linoleum, slipping futilely on the smoothness of it. "Boy, it's all right," Neville said quickly. The dog jerked around and backed into the corner, hackles rising, jaws drawn back all the way from its yellowish-white teeth, a half-mad sound quivering in its throat. Suddenly Neville knew what was wrong. It was nighttime, and the terrified dog was trying to dig itself a hole to bury itself in. He stood there helplessly, his brain refusing to work properly as the dog edged away from the corner, then scuttled underneath the workbench. An idea finally came. Neville moved to his bed quickly and pulled off the top blanket. Returning to the bench, he crouched down and looked under it. The dog was almost flattened against the wall, its body shaking violently, guttural snarls bubbling in its throat. "All right, boy," he said, "all right." The dog shrank back as Neville stuck the blanket underneath the bench and then stood up. Neville went over to the door and remained there a minute, looking back. "If only I could do something," he thought helplessly. "But I can't even get close to him." Well, he decided grimly, if the dog didn't accept him soon, he'd have to try a little chloroform. Then he could at least work on the dog, fix its paw, and try somehow to cure it. He went back to the kitchen, but he couldn't eat. Finally, he dumped the contents of his plate into the garbage disposal and poured the coffee back into the pot. In the living room, he made himself a drink and downed it. It tasted flat and unappetizing. He put down the glass and went back to the bedroom with a somber face. The dog had dug itself under the folds of the blanket, and there it was, still shaking, whining ceaselessly. No use trying to work on it now, he thought. It's too frightened. He walked back to the bed and sat down. He ran his hands through his hair and then put them over his face. "Cure it. Cure it," he thought, and one of his hands bunched into a fist to strike feebly at the mattress. Reaching out abruptly, he turned off the light and lay down fully clothed. Still lying down, he worked off his sandals and listened to them thump on the floor. Silence. He lay there staring at the ceiling. "Why don't I get up?" he wondered. "Why don't I try to do something?" He turned on his side. "Get some sleep." The words came automatically. He knew he wasn't going to sleep, though. He lay in the darkness, listening to the dogs whimpering. "Die. It's going to die," he kept thinking. "There's nothing in the world I can do." At last, unable to bear the sound, he reached over and switched on the bedside lamp. As he moved across the room in his stocking feet, he heard the dog trying suddenly to jerk loose from the blanketing, but it got all tangled up in the folds and began yelping, terror-stricken, while its body flailed wildly under the wool. Neville knelt beside it and put his hands on its body. He heard the choking snarl and the muffled click of its teeth as it snapped at him through the blanket. "All right," he said, "stop it now." The dog kept struggling against him, its high-pitched whining never stopping, its gaunt body shaking without control. Neville kept his hand firmly on its body, pinning it down, talking to it quietly, gently. "It's all right now, fella. All right. Nobody's gonna hurt you. Take it easy now. Come on. Relax now. Come on, boy. Take it easy. Relax. That's right. Relax. That's it. Calm down. Nobody's gonna hurt you. We'll take care of you." He went on talking intermittently for almost an hour, his voice a low, hypnotic murmuring in the silence of the room. And slowly, hesitantly, the dog's trembling eased off. A smile faltered on Neville's lips as he went on talking, talking. That's right. Take it easy now. We'll take care of you. Soon the dog lay still beneath his strong hands, the only movement its harsh breathing. Neville began patting its head, began running his right hand over its body, stroking and soothing. That's a good dog, he said softly. Good dog. I'll take care of you now. Nobody will hurt you. You understand, don't you, fella? Sure you do. Sure. You're my dog, aren't you? Carefully, he sat down on the cool linoleum, still patting the dog. You're a good dog. A good dog. His voice was calm. It was quiet with resignation. After about an hour, he picked up the dog. For a moment, it struggled and started whining, but Neville talked to it again, and it soon calmed down. He sat down on his bed and held the blanket-covered dog in his lap. He sat there for hours holding the dog, patting and stroking and talking. The dog lay immobile in his lap, breathing easier. It was about 11 that night when Neville slowly undid the blanket folds and exposed the dog's head. For a few minutes it cringed away from his hand, snapping a little. But he kept talking to it quietly, and after a while his hand rested on the warm neck and he was moving his fingers gently, scratching and caressing. He smiled down at the dog, his throat moving. You'll be all better soon, he whispered. Real soon. The dog looked up at him with its dulled, sick eyes, and then its tongue faltered out and licked roughly and moistly across the palm of Neville's hand. Something broke in Neville's throat. He sat there silently, while tears ran slowly down his cheeks. In a week, the dog was dead. Chapter 14. There was no debauch of drinking, far from it. He found that he actually drank less. Something had changed. Trying to analyze it, he came to the conclusion that his last drunk had put him on the bottom, at the very nadir of frustrated despair. Now, unless he put himself under the ground, the only way he could go was up. After the first few weeks of building up intense hope about the dog, it had slowly dawned on him that intense hope was not the answer and never had been. In a world of monotonous horror, there could be no salvation in wild dreaming. Horror he had adjusted to, but monotony was the greater obstacle, and he realized it now, understood it at long last, and understanding it seemed to give him a sort of quiet peace, a sense of having spread all the cards on his mental table, examined them, and settled conclusively on the desired hand. Burying the dog had not been the agony he had supposed it would be. In a way, it was almost like burying threadbare hopes and false excitements. From that day on, he learned to accept the dungeon he existed in, neither seeking to escape with sudden derring-do, nor beating his pate bloody on its walls. And, thus resigned, he returned to work. It had happened almost a year before, several days after he had put Virginia to her second and final rest. Hollow and bleak, a sense of absolute loss in him, he was walking the streets late one afternoon, hands listless at his sides, feet shuffling with the rhythm of despair. His face mirrored nothing of the helpless agony he felt. His face was a blank. He had wandered through the streets for hours, neither knowing nor caring where he was going. All he knew was that he couldn't return to the empty rooms of the house, couldn't look at the things they had touched and held and known with him. He couldn't look at Kathy's empty bed, at her clothes hanging still and useless in the closet, couldn't look at the bed that he and Virginia had slept in, at Virginia's clothes, her jewelry, all her perfumes on the bureau. He couldn't go near the house. And so he walked and wandered, and he didn't know where he was when the people started milling past him, when the man caught his arm and breathed garlic in his face. "Come, brother, come," the man said, his voice a grating rasp. He saw the man's throat moving like clammy turkey skin, the red-splotched cheeks, the feverish eyes, the black suit, unpressed, unclean.
Come and be saved, brother! Saved!
Robert Neville stared at the man. He didn't understand. The man pulled him on, his fingers like skeleton fingers on Neville's arm.
It's never too late, brother, said the man. Salvation comes to him who...
The last of his words were lost now in the rising murmur of sound from the great tent they were approaching. It sounded like the sea imprisoned under canvas, roaring to escape. Robert Neville tried to loose his arm.
I don't want to...
The man didn't hear. He pulled Neville on with him, and they walked toward the waterfall of crying and stamping. The man did not let go. Robert Neville felt as if he were being dragged into a tidal wave.
But I don't...
The tent had swallowed him then. The ocean of shouting, stamping, hand-clapping sound engulfed him. He flinched instinctively and felt his heart begin pumping heavily. He was surrounded now by people, hundreds of them, swelling and gushing around him like waters closing in, and yelling and clapping and crying out words Robert Neville couldn't understand. Then the cries died down, and he heard the voice that stabbed through the half-light like knifing doom, that crackled and bit shrilly over the loudspeaker system.
Do you want to fear the Holy Cross of God? Do you want to look into the mirror and not see the face that Almighty God has given you? Do you want to come crawling back from the grave like a monster out of hell?
The voice enjoined hoarsely, pulsing, driving.
Do you want to be changed into a black, unholy animal? Do you want to stain the evening sky with hell-born bat wings? I ask you, do you want to be turned into godless, night-cursed husks, into creatures of eternal damnation? No! The people erupted, terror-stricken. No! Save us!
Robert Neville backed away, bumping into flailing-handed, white-jawed true believers screaming out for succor from the lowering skies.
Well, I'm telling you, so listen to the word of God. Behold, evil shall go forth from nation to nation, and the slain of the Lord shall be at that day from one end of the earth even unto the other end of the earth. Is that a lie? Is that a lie? No! No! I tell you that unless we become as little children, stainless and pure in the eyes of our Lord, unless we stand up and shout out the glory of Almighty God and of His only begotten Son, Jesus Christ our Savior, unless we fall on our knees and beg forgiveness for our grievous offenses, we are damned. I'll say it again, so listen. We are damned. We are damned. We are damned. Amen! Save us!
The people twisted and moaned and smote their brows and shrieked in mortal terror and screamed out terrible hallelujahs. Robert Neville was shoved about, stumbling and lost in a treadmill of hopes, in a crossfire of frenzied worship.
God has punished us for our great transgressions. God has unleashed the terrible force of His almighty wrath. God has set loose the second deluge upon us, a deluge, a flood, a world-consuming torrent of creatures from hell. He has opened the grave. He has unsealed the crypt. He has turned the dead from their black tombs and set them upon us. And death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them. That's the word of God. Oh God, you have punished us, oh God. You have seen the terrible face of our transgressions, oh God. You have struck us with the might of your almighty wrath.
Clapping hands like the spatter of irregular rifle fire, swaying bodies like stalks in a terrible wind, moans of the great potential dead, screams of the fighting living. Robert Neville strained through their violent ranks, face white, hands before him like those of a blind man seeking shelter. He escaped, weak and trembling, stumbling away from them. Inside the tent, the people screamed, but night had already fallen. He thought about that now as he sat in the living room nursing a mild drink, a psychology text resting on his lap. A quotation had started the train of thought, sending him back to that evening 10 months before, when he'd been pulled into the wild revival meeting. This condition, known as hysterical blindness, may be partial or complete, including one, several, or all objects. That was the quotation he'd read. It had started him working on the problem again. A new approach now. Before, he had stubbornly persisted in attributing all vampire phenomena to the germ. If certain of these phenomena did not fit in with the bacilli, he felt inclined to judge their cause as superstition. True, he'd vaguely considered psychological explanations, but he'd never really given much credence to such a possibility. Now, released at last from unyielding preconceptions, he did. There was no reason, he knew, why some of the phenomena could not be physically caused, the rest psychological. And now that he accepted it, it seemed one of those patent answers that only a blind man would miss. Well, I always was the blind man type, he thought, in quiet amusement. Consider, he thought then, the shock undergone by a victim of the plague. Toward the end of the plague, yellow journalism had spread a cancerous dread of vampires to all corners of the nation. He could remember himself the rash of pseudo-scientific articles that veiled an out-and-out fright campaign designed to sell papers. There was something grotesquely amusing in that, the frenetic attempt to sell papers while the world died. Not that all newspapers had done that. Those papers that had lived in honesty and integrity died the same way. Yellow journalism, though, had been rampant in the final days. And in addition, a great upsurge in revivalism had occurred. In a typical desperation for quick answers, easily understood, people had turned to primitive worship as the solution, with less than success. Not only had they died as quickly as the rest of the people, but they had died with terror in their hearts, with a mortal dread flowing in their very veins. And then Robert Neville thought, to have this hideous dread vindicated, to regain consciousness beneath hot, heavy soil, and know that death had not brought rest, to find themselves clawing up through the earth, their bodies driven now by a strange, hideous need. Such traumatic shocks could undo what mind was left, and such shocks could explain much. The cross, first of all. Once they were forced to accept vindication of the dread of being repelled by an object that had been a focal point of worship, their minds could have snapped. Dread of the cross sprang up, and, driven on despite already created dreads, the vampire could have acquired an intense mental loathing, and this self-hatred could have set up a block in their weakened minds, causing them to be blind to their own abhorred image. It could make them lonely, soul-lost slaves of the night, afraid to approach anyone, living a solitary existence, often seeking solace in the soil of their native land, struggling to gain a sense of communion with something, with anything. The water? That he did accept as superstition, a carryover of the traditional legend that witches were incapable of crossing running water, as written down in the story of Tam O'Shanter. Witches, vampires. In all these feared beings, there was a sort of interwoven kinship. Legends and superstitions could overlap, and did. And the living vampires? That was simple, too, now. In life, there were the deranged, the insane. What better hold than vampirism for these to catch on to? He was certain that all the living who came to his house at night were insane, thinking themselves true vampires, although actually they were only demented sufferers. And that would explain the fact that they'd never taken the obvious step of burning his house. They simply could not think that logically. He remembered the man who one night had climbed to the top of a light post in front of the house and, while Robert Neville had watched through the peephole, had leaped into space, waving his arms frantically. Neville hadn't been able to explain it at the time, but now the answer seemed obvious. The man had thought he was a bat. Neville sat looking at the half-finished drink, a thin smile fastened to his lips. So, he thought, slowly, surely, we find out about them. Find out that they are no invincible race. Far from it, They are a highly perishable race, requiring the strictest of physical conditions for the furtherance of their godforsaken existence. He put the drink down on the table. I don't need it, he thought. My emotions don't need feeding anymore. I don't need liquor for forgetting or for escaping. I don't have to escape from anything. Not now. For the first time since the dog had died, he smiled and felt within himself a quiet, well-modulated satisfaction. There were still many things to learn, but not so many as before. Strangely, life was becoming almost bearable. I don the robe of hermit without a cry, he thought. On the phonograph, music played, quiet and unhurried. Outside, the vampires waited. Part 3, June 1978. Chapter 15. He was out hunting for Cortman. It had become a relaxing hobby, hunting for Cortman, one of the few diversions left to him. On those days when he didn't care to leave the neighborhood and there was no demanding work to be done on the house, he would search, under cars, behind bushes, under houses, up fireplaces, in closets, under beds, in refrigerators, any place into which a moderately corpulent male body could conceivably be squeezed. Ben Cortman could be in any one of those places at one time or another. He changed his hiding place constantly. Neville felt certain that Cortman knew he was singled out for capture. He felt, further, that Cortman relished the peril of it. If the phrase were not such an obvious anachronism, Neville would have said that Ben Cortman had a zest for life. Sometimes he thought Cortman was happier now than he ever had been before. Neville ambled slowly up Compton Boulevard toward the next house he meant to search. An uneventful morning had passed. Cortman was not found, even though Neville knew he was somewhere in the neighborhood. He had to be, because he was always the first one at the house at night. The other ones were almost always strangers. Their turnover was great, because they invariably stayed in the neighborhood, and Neville found them and destroyed them. Not Cortman. As he strolled, Neville wondered again what he'd do if he found Cortman. True, his plan had always been the same. Immediate disposal. But that was on the surface. He knew it wouldn't be that easy. Oh, it wasn't that he felt anything toward Cortman. It wasn't even that Cortman represented a part of the past. The past was dead, and he knew it, and accepted it. No, it wasn't either of those things. What it probably was, Neville decided, was that he didn't want to cut off a recreational activity. The rest were such dull, robot-like creatures. Ben, at least, had some imagination. For some reason, his brain hadn't weakened like the others. It could be, Neville often theorized, that Ben Cortman was born to be dead. Undead, that is, he thought, a wry smile playing on his full lips. It no longer occurred to him that Cortman was out to kill him. That was a negligible menace. Neville sank down on the next porch with a slow groan. Then, reaching lethargically into his pocket, he took out his pipe. With an idle thumb, he tamped rough tobacco shreds down into the pipe bowl. In a few moments, smoke swirls were floating lazily about his head in the warm, still air. It was a bigger, more relaxed Neville that gazed out across the wide field on the other side of the boulevard. An evenly paced hermit life had increased his weight to 230 pounds. His face was full, his body broad and muscular underneath the loose-fitting denim he wore. He had long before given up shaving. Only rarely did he crop his thick blonde beard so that it remained 2 or 3 inches from his skin. His hair was thinning and was long and straggly. Set in the deep tan of his face, his blue eyes were calm and unexcitable. He leaned back against the brick step, puffing out slow clouds of smoke. Far out across that field, he knew there was still a depression in the ground where he had buried Virginia, where she had unburied herself. But knowing it brought no glimmer of reflective sorrow to his eyes. Rather than go on suffering, he had learned to stultify himself to introspection. Time had lost its multidimensional scope. There was only the present for Robert Neville, a present based on day-to-day survival, marked by neither heights of joy nor depths of despair. I am predominantly vegetable, he often thought to himself. That was the way he wanted it. Robert Neville sat gazing at the white spot out in the field for several minutes before he realized that it was moving. His eyes blinked once, and the skin tightened over his face. He made a slight sound in his throat, a sound of doubting question. Then, standing up, he raised his left hand to shade the sunlight from his eyes. His teeth bit convulsively into the pipe stem. A woman. He didn't even try to catch the pipe when it fell from his mouth as his jaw went slack. For a long, breathless moment, he stood there on the porch step, staring. He closed his eyes, opened them. She was still there. Robert Neville felt the increasing thud in his chest as he watched the woman. She didn't see him. Her head was down as she walked across the long field. He could see her reddish hair blowing in the breeze, her arms swinging loosely at her sides. His throat moved. It was such an incredible sight after 3 years that his mind could not assimilate it. He kept blinking and staring as he stood motionless in the shade of the house. A woman. Alive. In the daylight. He stood, mouth partly open, gaping at the woman. She was young, he could see now as she came closer. Probably in her 20s. She wore a wrinkled and dirty white dress. She was very tan. Her hair was red. In the dead silence of the afternoon, Neville thought he heard the crunch of her shoes in the long grass. I've gone mad. The words presented themselves abruptly. He felt less shock at that possibility than he did at the notion that she was real. He had, in fact, been vaguely preparing himself for just such a delusion. It seemed feasible. The man who died of thirst saw mirages of lakes. Why shouldn't a man who thirsted for companionship see a woman walking in the sun? He started suddenly. No, it wasn't that. For unless his delusion had sound as well as sight, he now heard her walking through the grass. He knew it was real. The movement of her hair, of her arms. She still looked at the ground. Who was she? Where was she going? Where had she been? He didn't know what welled up in him. It was too quick to analyze, an instinct that broke through every barrier of time-erected reserve. His left arm went up. Hi! He cried. He jumped down to the sidewalk. Hi there! A moment of sudden, complete silence. Her head jerked up, and they looked at each other. Alive, he thought. Alive! He wanted to shout more, but he felt suddenly choked up. His tongue felt wooden. His brain refused to function. Alive! The word kept repeating itself in his mind. Alive! 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 With a sudden twisting motion, the young woman turned and began running wildly back across the field. For a moment, Neville stood there twitching, uncertain of what to do. Then his heart seemed to burst, and he lunged across the sidewalk. His boots jolted down into the street and thudded across. Wait! He heard himself cry. The woman did not wait. He saw her bronze legs pumping as she fled across the uneven surface of the field, and suddenly he realized that words could not stop her. He thought of how shocked he had been at seeing her, how much more shocked she must have felt, hearing a sudden shout end long silence and seeing a great bearded man waving at her. His legs drove him up over the other curb and into the field. His heart was pounding heavily now. She's alive, he couldn't stop thinking that. Alive, a woman, alive. She couldn't run as fast as he could. Almost immediately, Neville began catching up with her. She glanced back over her shoulder with terrified eyes. I won't hurt you, he cried, but she kept running. Suddenly she tripped and went crashing down on one knee. Her face turned again, and he saw the twisted fright on it. I won't hurt you, he yelled again. With a desperate lunge, she regained her footing and ran on. No sound now but the sound of her shoes and his boots thrashing through the heavy grass. He began jumping over the grass to avoid its impending height and gained more ground. The skirt of her dress whipped against the grass, holding her back. Stop! He cried again, but more from instinct than with any hope that she would stop. She didn't. She ran still faster, and gritting his teeth, Neville put another burst of speed into his pursuit. He followed in a straight line as the girl weaved across the field, her light reddish hair billowing behind her. Now he was so close he could hear her tortured breathing. He didn't like to frighten her, but he couldn't stop now. Everything else in the world seemed to have fallen from view but her. He had to catch her. His long, powerful legs pistoned on, his boots thudded on the earth. Another stretch of field. The two of them ran, panting. She glanced back at him again to see how close he was. He didn't realize how frightening he looked. 6'3" in his boots, a gigantic bearded man with an intent look. Now his hand lurched out, and he caught her by the right shoulder. With a gasping scream, the young woman twisted away and stumbled to the side. Losing balance, she fell on one hip on the rocky ground. Neville jumped forward to help her up. She scuttled back over the ground and tried to get up, but she slipped and fell again, this time on her back. Her skirt jerked up over her knees. She shoved herself up with a breathless whimper, her dark eyes terrified. "Here," he gasped, reaching out his hand. She slapped it aside with a slight cry and struggled to her feet. He caught her by the arm, and her free hand lashed out, raking jagged nails across his forehead and right temple. With a grunt, he jerked back his arm, and she whirled and began running again. Neville jumped forward again and caught her by the shoulders. "What are you afraid?" He couldn't finish. Her hand drove stingingly across his mouth. Then there was only the sound of gasping and struggling, of their feet scrabbling and slipping on the earth, crackling down the thick grass. "Will you stop?" he cried, but she kept battling. She jerked back, and his taut fingers ripped away part of her dress. He let go, and the material fluttered down to her waist. He saw her tan shoulder and the white brassiere cup over her left breast. She clawed out at him, and he caught her wrists in an iron grip. Her right foot drove a bone-numbing kick to his shin. "Damn it!" With a snarl of rage, he drove his right palm across her face. She staggered back, then looked at him dizzily. Abruptly, she started crying helplessly. She sank to her knees before him, holding her arms over her head as if to ward off further blows. Neville stood there gasping, looking down at her cringing form. He blinked, then took a deep breath. "Get up," he said. "I'm not going to hurt you." She didn't raise her head. He looked down confusedly at her. He didn't know what to say. "I said I'm not going to hurt you," he told her again. She looked up, but his face seemed to frighten her again, for she shrank back. She crouched there, looking up at him fearfully. "What are you afraid of?" he asked. He didn't realize that his voice was devoid of warmth, that it was the harsh, sterile voice of a man who had lost all touch with humanity. He took a step toward her, and she drew back again with a frightened gasp. He extended his hand. "Here," he said. "Stand up." She got up slowly, but without his help. Noticing suddenly her exposed breast, she reached down and held up the torn material of her dress. They stood there breathing harshly and looking at each other. And, now that the first shock had passed, Neville didn't know what to say. He'd been dreaming of this moment for years. His dreams had never been like this.
What's your name?" he asked.
She didn't answer. Her eyes stayed on his face. Her lips kept trembling.
"Well?"
he asked loudly, and she flinched.
Ruth?
Her voice faltered. A shudder ran through Robert Neville's body. The sound of her voice seemed to loosen everything in him. Questions disappeared. He felt his heart beating heavily. He almost felt as if he were going to cry. His hand moved out almost unconsciously. Her shoulder trembled under his palm.
"Ruth,"
he said in a flat, lifeless voice. His throat moved as he stared at her.
"Ruth,"
he said again. The two of them, the man and the woman, stood facing each other in the great, hot field. Chapter 16. The woman lay motionless on his bed, sleeping. It was past 4 in the afternoon. At least 20 times Neville had stolen into the bedroom to look at her and see if she were awake. Now he sat in the kitchen drinking coffee and worrying.
What if she is infected, though? He argued with himself. The worry had started a few hours before, while Ruth was sleeping. Now he couldn't rid himself of the fear. No matter how he reasoned, it didn't help. All right, she was tanned from the sun. She had been walking in the daylight. The dog had been in the daylight, too. Neville's fingers tapped restlessly on the table. Simplicity had departed. The dream had faded into disturbing complexity. There had been no wondrous embrace, no magic words spoken. Beyond her name, he had got nothing from her. Getting her to the house had been a battle. Getting her to enter had been even worse. She had cried and begged him not to kill her. No matter what he said to her, she kept crying and begging. He had visualized something on the order of a Hollywood production, stars in their eyes, entering the house, arms about each other, fade out. Instead, he had been forced to tug and cajole and argue and scold while she held back. The entrance had been less than romantic. He had to drag her in. Once in the house, she had been no less frightened. He'd tried to act comfortingly, but all she did was cower in one corner, the way the dog had done. She wouldn't eat or drink anything he gave her. Finally, he'd been compelled to take her in the bedroom and lock her in. Now she was asleep. He sighed wearily and fingered the handle of his cup. All these years, he thought, dreaming about a companion. Now I meet one, and the first thing I do is distrust her, treat her crudely and impatiently. And yet there was really nothing else he could do. He had accepted too long the proposition that he was the only normal person left. It didn't matter that she looked normal. He'd seen too many of them lying in their coma that looked as healthy as she. They weren't, though, and he knew it. The simple fact that she had been walking in the sunlight wasn't enough to tip the scales on the side of trusting acceptance. He had doubted too long. His concept of the society had become iron-bound. It was almost impossible for him to believe that there were others like him. And after the first shock had diminished, all the dogma of his long years alone had asserted itself. With a heavy breath, he rose and went back to the bedroom. She was still in the same position. Maybe, he thought, she's gone back into coma again. He stood over the bed, staring down at her. Ruth. There was so much about her he wanted to know. And yet he was almost afraid to find out, because if she were like the others, there was only one course open. And it was better not to know anything about the people you killed. His hands twitched at his sides. His blue eyes gazed flatly at her. What if she had been a freak occurrence? What if she had snapped out of coma for a little while and gone wandering? It seemed possible. And yet, as far as he knew, daylight was the one thing the germ could not endure. Why wasn't that enough to convince him she was normal? Well, there was only one way to make sure. He bent over and put his hand on her shoulder. Wake up, he said. She didn't stir. His mouth tightened and his fingers drew in on her soft shoulder. Then he noticed the thin golden chain around her throat. Reaching in with rough fingers, he drew it out of the bosom of her dress. He was looking at the tiny gold cross when she woke up and recoiled into the pillow. She's not in a coma. That was all he thought.
What are you doing?
She asked faintly. It was harder to distrust her when she spoke. The sound of the human voice was so strange to him that it had a power over him he had never noticed before.
I'm nothing, he said.
Awkwardly, he stepped back and leaned against the wall. He looked at her a moment longer, then he asked,
Where are you from?
She lay there looking blankly at him.
I asked you where you were from, he said.
Again she said nothing. He pushed himself away from the wall with a tight look on his face.
Inglewood,
she said hastily. He looked at her coldly for a moment, then leaned back against the wall.
I see, he said. Did you live alone?
I was married.
Where is your husband?
Her throat moved.
He's dead.
For how long?
last week.
And what did you do after he died?
Ran.
She bit into her lower lip.
I ran away.
You mean you've been wandering all this time?
Yes.
He looked at her without a word. Then abruptly he turned, and his boots thumped loudly as he walked into the kitchen. Pulling open a cabinet door, he drew down a handful of garlic cloves. He put them on a dish, tore them into pieces, and mashed them to a pulp. The acrid fumes assailed his nostrils. She was propped up on one elbow when he came back. Without hesitation, he pushed the dish almost to her face. She turned her head away with a faint cry.
"What are you doing?"
she asked, and coughed once. "Why do you turn away?"
"Please,
why do you turn away?"
"It smells!"
Her voice broke into a sob.
"Don't! You're making me sick!"
He pushed the plate still closer to her face. With a gagging sound, she backed away and pressed against the wall, her legs drawn up on the bed.
"Stop it, please!"
she begged. He drew back the dish and watched her body twitching as her stomach convulsed.
"You're one of them,"
he said to her, quietly venomous. She sat up suddenly and ran past him into the bathroom. The door slammed behind her, and he could hear the sound of her terrible retching. Thin-lipped, he put the dish down on the bedside table. His throat moved as he swallowed. Infected. It had been a clear sign. He had learned over a year before that garlic was an allergen to any system infected with the Vampyrus bacillus. When the system was exposed to garlic, the stimulated tissues sensitized the cells, causing an abnormal reaction to any further contact with garlic. That was why putting it into their veins had accomplished little. They had to be exposed to the odor. He sank down on the bed, and the woman had reacted in the wrong way. After a moment, Robert Neville frowned. If what she had said was true, she had been wandering around for a week. She would naturally be exhausted and weak, and under those conditions, the smell of so much garlic could have made her retch. His fists thudded down onto the mattress. He still didn't know then, not for certain. And objectively, he knew he had no right to decide on inadequate evidence. It was something he'd learned the hard way, something he knew and believed absolutely. He was still sitting there when she unlocked the bathroom door and came out. She stood in the hall a moment looking at him, then went into the living room. He rose and followed. When he came into the living room, she was sitting on the couch.
"Are you satisfied?"
she asked. "Never mind that," he said. "You're on trial, not me." She looked up angrily, as if she meant to say something. Then her body slumped, and she shook her head. He felt a twinge of sympathy for a moment. She looked so helpless, her thin hands resting on her lap. She didn't seem to care anymore about her torn dress. He looked at the slight swelling of her breast. Her figure was very slim, almost curveless, not at all like the woman he'd used to envision. "Never mind that," he told himself. "That doesn't matter anymore." He sat down in the chair and looked across at her. She didn't return his gaze. "Listen to me," he said then. "I have every reason to suspect you of being infected, especially now that you've reacted in such a way to garlic." She said nothing. "Haven't you anything to say?" he asked. She raised her eyes.
"You think I'm one of them?" she said.
"I think you might be."
"And what about this?"
she asked, holding up her cross. "That means nothing," he said.
"I'm awake," she said. "I'm not in a coma."
He said nothing. It was something he couldn't argue with, even though it didn't assuage doubt. "I've been in Inglewood many times," he said finally. "Why didn't you hear my car?"
"Inglewood is a big place," she said.
He looked at her carefully, his fingers tapping on the arm of the chair. "I'd like to believe you," he said.
"Would you?"
she asked. Another stomach contraction hit her, and she bent over with a gasp, teeth clenched. Robert Neville sat there wondering why he didn't feel more compassion for her. Emotion was a difficult thing to summon from the dead, though. He had spent it all and felt hollow now, without feeling. After a moment, she looked up. Her eyes were hard.
I've had a weak stomach all my life, she said. I saw my husband killed last week, torn to pieces right in front of my eyes. I saw it. I lost two children in the plague, and for